This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sheila Shoiga, and welcome to Ready to Be Real Conversations, the podcast series where I chat to people of all walks of life. Some names you'll recognise, others you might not, but my hope is that these conversations will at times inspire, challenge, educate, comfort, or simply entertain you. This week, I speak to Aoife O'Brien about life with and after an eating disorder.
VD is like an abusive partner that's constantly... What did you eat today? What did you do? Look at the state. Yeah, it's literally like, yeah, if you were living with an abusive partner that was monitoring what you ate, what you said, what you thought every minute of the day, like that's what it's like living with it. And I suppose getting away from that then, it's so freeing and strange and like just lovely not to, just to become your own best friend and not to be that bully in your head monitoring everything you do 24/7.
Originally from County Clare, Aoife now lives in Mayo with her fiancé Damien and her son Liam, who's nearly two. For years, she was controlled by an eating disorder, which went unnoticed for a long time. But now, having fully recovered, she's passionate about getting the message out that life after disordered eating is very much possible. In this conversation, we discuss diet culture, the signs of eating distress, and how best to address it. I learned a lot from listening to her, and I think you will as well. Aoife, thank you so much for joining me today to have this conversation and be so open about your experience with an eating disorder. I know you don't call it an eating disorder, you call it eating distress.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
So we'll explain that a little bit later on. Mm-hmm. But first up, can you talk to me about, you know, your childhood growing up, what your attitude and your relationship with food was like when you were a kid?
I suppose as a kid, I don't remember having any issues with food or anything like that. And I suppose... it's probably important as well that I suppose you're not born uncomfortable in your body, and it's something that you kind of learn. So it's not there naturally as a baby. But yeah, as a kid, I think, yeah, I do have like free moments that I can remember where size was definitely not an issue. And it's nice to have those. Like I grew up on a farm and running around the fields with my cousins and stuff like that, and brothers and sisters, because I do know a lot of people that have ED can never remember a time when they were kind of free. So, okay. I'm glad that I have those memories. But I suppose things like when you're a child, it wouldn't have been issues with my body, but it would have been maybe I would have put a lot of pressure on myself from a very young age, would have been a high achiever, very studious. You know, it'd be the end of the world if I didn't get 10 out of 10 on a spelling test in primary school, that kind of thing.
All right, okay. A perfectionist?
Yeah, a lot of perfectionistic traits, if you want to call it. Definitely. And would have compared myself a lot from a young age. And it was only kind of on reflection, looking back, I think there was always, even from a young age, that sense of I didn't really feel like I fitted in kind of a thing. And I always felt like I felt a lot of discomfort in my body. And like going back, this is probably the earliest memory I have feeling discomfort in my body. And it was funny, I was thinking back, I was at like a sleepover with girls in my class. And I must have been 9, I think, because I remember having a pajamas that was size 7 to 8 years old. And like, it's just weird to think back like the child that young would be aware of that. I remember being like wanting everyone to see, look, I'm 9, but I'm wearing size 7 to 8 in my pajamas. Okay, and like when I think that now, I'm like, that's fucking weird. Like, but it just shows, I suppose, from a young age, like, and probably even younger, but that's my first memory of kind of feeling that sizeism, if you want to say. Just kind of noticing that in my body.
And seeing it as something to celebrate.
Yeah, from such a young age, I don't know where that would have came from, like, at all. And as well, like, I can remember, like, playing camogie and at cool camps, I can remember feeling really uncomfortable in my body. And I suppose then getting older and kind of developing boobs and stuff like that, just, I would have developed quite early and just really not been comfortable in my own skin. So, yeah, I don't know if that was anything, early signs or anything that obviously I wouldn't have been aware at the time. I just remember feeling that discomfort and always having that sensation that, like, I wanted to be liked and wanted to please people and wanted to be popular. That was in me from a young age as well, that kind of people pleasing and just wanting to fit in. I can remember that deeply. But as well, I think one thing to kind of look out for, maybe even in your, not even to look out for, but like most people that would experience eating distress or an eating disorder would be hypersensitive. So like something could be said and you would take it in at such a deep level and you'd remember it and replay it. Like just maybe a comment someone might have said. And just even like if something you did that you thought was negative that day, that would stay with you for a long time. Whereas all the praise in the world you got, it just didn't. It was like there was no filtering mechanism. Yeah. You like absorb the negativity like a sponge.
Yeah. And not be able to accept the positive comments. Yeah. So you've said it there yourself. And I think it would be great to explain it a bit better because we keep hearing about eating disordered or disordered eating. But until you said it to me, I had never heard the term eating distress. Yeah. And that's what you prefer to call it.
Yeah. And yeah, I think it's just like it's the distress that's eating you, really. And that you're not disordered because you're going through this.
Yeah.
And I think you have such low self-esteem when you are experiencing an eating distress, like it's in the minus. So I think for some people that label might kind of maybe they're feeling quite vulnerable as it is and then being told they're disordered mightn't be very helpful.
Yeah, okay.
So you're experiencing a high level of distress and that distress is eating you. Just I suppose the language, just a nicer
term. Importance of language.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely.
Because as well, as you just said there, if you are somebody that really will absorb any negativity, mm-hmm. any negative words or connotations around something, it is important to observe that. So I have found that even leading up to this conversation today, from our voice notes and from reading and listening to different people's experiences, that I feel like there's a lot I didn't know and that I'm only starting to learn about this area and how common it is. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's obviously different levels of extreme on the scale, but I think the majority of us have probably experienced an eating distress in one way or another. It might not be as extreme that we need to go for treatment for it, but it's probably enough that it needs a little bit of attention. So as you said, it was only when you started to think about it that perhaps there were slight signs from an early enough age that you did have a little bit of an issue around how you looked, more so than probably how it manifested eating food. Am I right in thinking that?
Yeah, it would have been just discomfort in my own skin, in my own body, just not feeling comfortable and very conscious. But yeah, I don't remember, like it was never any issues with food or doing anything around that. It was just that discomfort within myself. And I'd imagine from speaking to a lot of people, that's kind of, yeah, like that's how it kind of does begin, I suppose, that discomfort in yourself and not feeling like you kind of fit in.
And it wasn't until your late teens that it really starts to ramp up and become an obvious thing in your life.
Yeah. So, and I think like you mentioned a good point there, like that a lot of people would experience distress around food or discomfort in their body or body image. I don't think anybody probably goes through life being immune to that, especially in the times we're living in now, especially like, you know, there's so much emphasis on eating clean, your fitness, clean eating. Like there's just, it's so normal. Like disordered kind of behaviors are very normalized now. And I think that's why it can be very hard to kind of spot that you are maybe experiencing that there's something deeper going on, and for parents or family members or people to even notice, because it's celebrated to watch what you're eating too.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm being good this week, I'm on a diet, I'm, do you know, my body's a temple. Like, that's all normalized and celebrated. So, like, I think if you look at other kind of addictions or substance, like, they might be more obvious because some more than others. But I suppose, yeah, it's really normalized in society, yeah, those behaviors.
And it is. There's also a term, I don't know if it's an official term, but I see it being bandied about, orthorexia, mm-hmm, which I hadn't even heard of. But it's basically an obsession with clean eating, mm-hmm, exercise, never eating anything, you know, air quotes, bad,
yeah,
and constantly just, you know, fueling up on good food. And then you have all of these different types of food plans that I suppose it's easy then to hide behind. Is it, yeah, paleo? Is it keto?
Yeah, yeah.
Is it veganism?
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with them, and I'm not, yeah, demonizing them. But if they're used in the extreme,
yeah,
that's when it can be an issue. And I think we're not having enough conversation around this.
Yeah. I could not judge anyone, even if I wanted to, because I have tried every diet, every craze, every fad under the sun. And like,
really?
Yeah. So like now it just seems like a different lifetime ago, to be honest. But like, yeah, I couldn't. It might seem sometimes like that I'm very harsh and against that just because I know how destructive it is for people.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, I don't judge anyone because no one's immune to that kind of diet culture, and we should fit into these boxes.
Absolutely. I've done it myself.
Exactly.
Yeah. So it was 19 when it really kind of, the whole dieting kind of really kicked in for you.
Yeah, and I can remember, like, obviously, yeah, there was those issues going on in the background, like my sleep was disturbed, very studious in secondary school, leaving cert, a lot of stress, that kind of stuff. But yeah, the kind of the behaviors with food, definitely I can pinpoint when it started, like when I started Weight Watchers at the time with my older cousin.
Mm.
And I just remember, like, it was so easy. I just started losing weight. I was good at it and I was getting compliments for it. So I suppose for me, I didn't know myself at all. I had no sense of self whatsoever, but I didn't realize at the time. It's only in reflection looking back. So this kind of gave me a purpose or something to do or something to kind of to be. And I was great at it and I was getting compliments. And it just, I got hooked on that kind of that feeling, I suppose, and that air quotes high and false confidence, I suppose, that weight, yeah, loss gives you, is that false confidence. But I think as that progresses and coming out the other end, the goalposts always move, no matter where you got or what your goal was. It's never enough, and the goalposts always do move.
It depends on the personality type you are as well. And if you were slightly competitive or you were comparing yourself to others, you were probably in a zone where each week when you went, you wanted to be down. Was that the way it was?
Oh, completely. And like, competitive would have definitely been a way to describe me, definitely. Yeah, 100%. And like, the thing is as well, like, your body is smart. Like, if you're depriving your body and you're restricting, which I would have been doing, like, there's so many different behaviors, and I think it's important that it doesn't all fit into one box or one label, like anorexia, bulimia, orthorexia. Like, a lot of people I know, including myself, you would have ticked all boxes and dabbled in all sorts of behaviors. So I think it's important to even, first of all, kind of like, I was never underweight. I was in the normal weight category, looked well, didn't look like your stereotypical sick person that has an eating disorder, like that sensationalized in the magazines or the media, that kind of thing. So yeah, that I suppose as well would kind of mask that you might be having an issue, because you're not underweight, you're not sick looking, and it's normalized, and that's what you do when you go to Weight Watchers. And like, I think right now it's bizarre, you go in and pay someone who used to be a tenner and to weigh you and hop off the scale, like, and it's so inaccurate as well. Like, it makes me laugh now coming out the other end of it, but at the time it wasn't a laughing matter. My God, if I hadn't,
sure,
lost, like, Jesus, like, my body was like an emotional punch bag if I didn't meet whatever targets I set out to meet. Like,
yeah,
yeah, it was very, yeah, very, a really confusing time, I suppose, and very extreme and up and down. And food, I suppose, would have occupied my mind 24/7. It would have been thinking about food, what am I going to eat, when am I going to eat, like, minute by minute throughout the day. Like,
obsessed.
It does totally, yeah, become obsession. And like,
yeah,
your mind is so busy that it's very hard to be present in the room with anyone you're with or what you're doing, because this is going on all the time in your head, but no one kind of knows. Well, they probably do know, because I suppose all I did was talk about food and stuff as well. Like, I'd say I was very irritating to hang out with. Like, do anything that got in the way of my routine or the day or my meals or my exercise. Like, I started over exercising a lot to compensate what I was eating, that kind of stuff. And they're just things for maybe people to look out for, like calorie counting, sudden interest in good or bad foods, maybe interest in veganism if it doesn't really kind of align to the rest of your values, things to maybe look out for like that. Yeah, like taking like diet pills. Like when I think of what I used to put into my body without research and what was behind it, or like I just,
yeah,
it's just, it's bizarre to me now, I suppose, but it is the norm for a lot of people, unfortunately.
You said something really interesting in one of your voice notes to me when you said you saw your body as an ornament,
yeah,
rather than having a function and, you know, keeping you alive and doing all these wonderful things for you on a daily basis. And again, I think the reason I'm highlighting that is I think a lot of people at different stages have felt that way about their bodies.
Yeah.
That it is something just to be viewed and look a certain way rather than actually, what is it doing for you every day? Keeping you alive, keeping you healthy.
Yeah. And it's only when I started recovering that even that concept came into my head. Like I would have, like my body is an instrument or it's for living. Like what? Like what are you like? That was for the hippies. Like as in it was completely like what you look like. Very judgmental, very self-critical. But like if you're judging, I'm not saying you as in from my own experience,
sure,
but I was
yeah.
judging myself. I was judging and creeping on others as well. Like, you know, you can't be just doing it yourself and not doing it to others. So yeah, it was. And then a lot of shame around that as well. And just I suppose how you can get your identity can come wrapped up in it as well, because I was good at it. It just became, okay, that's Aoife who's good at exercising and diet, and that's all I spoke about, because I think behind that I didn't know what was there. I didn't know who I was. There was not much other substance going on, because I just rejected myself and I just became this walk and weight loss advocate. And I suppose the louder I shouted about it, I suppose people wouldn't recognise maybe that I was a fraud behind it all, kind of a thing. And like I started studying, like I did a master's in nutrition, started working in the weight loss area for years. So yeah, like looking back, like there's still, not still, but like a bit of shame as well that, like that's why I'm saying I couldn't judge, because it wasn't that long ago, less than 10 years ago, 6-7 years ago, that I was promoting diet culture and I had individual one-to-one clients who definitely, I'd say, had eating disorders at the time, but I wasn't aware of that. I could only, all I knew was weight loss and that kind of mindset, how to lose weight. So I was seeing clients promoting weight loss and healthy living in air quotes, but like I was very, my relationship, my body was so unbalanced and so, I suppose warped. And then that's what I was promoting to other people to lose weight. So yeah, it's just a funny one. And I suppose as well, like nutrition and wellness, it's not very regulated. Like I obviously was qualified, but like, do you know, was I in the right position to be doing that job? Yeah, so I think it's just important for people where they're getting their information from, especially now, like social media wouldn't have been as big then. Like it wasn't an issue for me at all. Back then it just wasn't really a thing. But especially now when there's so, and not to dish influencers or people online, but like just watch where you're getting your information from, because there's a lot of wellness advocates, again in air quotes, that they mightn't be so well behind at all.
But the thing is as well, is in society, as you and I know, and so many people listening will know, thin is celebrated. And there's a privilege that comes with being slim. You get more notice, you get more praise. I know as somebody who's gone up and down in weight that whenever I've dropped weight, I'll get the compliments. You're looking great. What have you done? And when I've gained it, there's nothing. It's like radio silence. Because, but behind it, what are they thinking? What is the thought process going on behind it? And I know there's a whole move now towards body positivity that is wonderful and great. But there's also people that will say that that is maybe not so good for people either. But I do think we have to get to a place of just acceptance that we all come in shapes and sizes. And the thin size or the bigger size, one is not better than the other. But we just need to get a bit more neutral with it. We're not neutral with it. As you said, you've mentioned judgment and shame. And I've experienced it myself. And it's very destructive as a force, isn't it? To have that type of judgment or feel like you're shamed to look a certain way. But when you talk about when you went to get weighed or get checked, and you fell within the normal parameters. Are you speaking about the BMI?
Yeah, so I was within the normal BMI category. And even when I first started seeking help, going through the recovery journey as well, I found it hard to accept that I even had an eating disorder, because I was kind of like, what? Like, even though how destructive and how it controlled my life, the ED, it was still my norm. I didn't know really any different. And I don't really remember being pulled on it. But then again, maybe I could have been, and I just didn't want to know or didn't want to hear about it. I knew deep down I had kind of issues with food and stuff like that. But I don't think I knew anything other than like anorexia or bulimia, that was what an eating disorder was. So I never once thought that that's what I had. I knew I had a very weird relationship with food, and food would dictate my mood, and it was very extreme, up and down, good and bad, on and off, that kind of thing.
So, I mean, suppose for people listening, BMI is body mass index, and it's the measure that normally you're told whether you're in the normal range or whether you're underweight or overweight or obese. But obviously it doesn't take into account the person's skeletal structure, how much muscle they have versus fat and all the rest. So it's quite a crude system that is still used.
Yeah. And like, your weight could fluctuate in the space of an hour if you measured yourself at different stages of the day. And I used to do that, and used to be upset that it would change and be upset with myself rather than actually thinking, okay, this system is very, like, it's not helpful, it's not right, you know what I mean? But I suppose the scales was what it said was right, you know, and everyone's questioned that the scales isn't right. It's not a helpful measure. And I think when I first started recovering, the advice I'd been given was just to throw out the weighing scale. And that was 5 or 6 years ago now, and I've never weighed myself since. And there's something really freeing in that as well. Like, and at the start now, it's easy for me to say that looking back, but at the start, that was very distressing in itself. How would you know what to do? What could guide you? What would keep you in shape? What would keep you together? Like, because I'd no trust in my body, that your body knows where it needs to be. Like, that was all, like, I could not even comprehend that. So yeah, it was very liberating after a while, but very kind of strange at the beginning, because when you're used to weighing and restricting and, you know, calculating, everything is kind of adding up numbers, that kind of thing. Yeah, it's strange. But yeah, I just got rid of the weighing scale. I've never done it since. Like, a few times I would have had to been weighed during pregnancy and stuff like that. And like, I wasn't fully recovered, I wouldn't say, going into pregnancy. Like, I'm mother nearly 2 years now, but I found the pregnancy really helped me to recover in one sense, because I could see what my body was doing as well. Like, I did find it a bit distressing as well, but like, also I could see what my body was doing. And when I did get weighed, it just didn't really bother me. It was just something that had to be done. I probably could have refused if I wanted to, but the scales didn't have that power over me anymore. It was like, get weighed, told me what it was, that's grand. It didn't linger with me. And that was really freeing in itself, to know, like, it doesn't matter what the weighing scales say, like, I feel freer and better than I've ever did. But like, looking back, like, the ED can be very manipulative as well, that I could look back in the past and look at pictures and be like, geez, I looked great. And like, that real kind of rose tinted glasses. It's like the ED not wanting to let go. You're looking back going, geez, I look great. But like, what was behind that picture? I was misery. I was obsessed. Like, I was not happy. I was not present. Like, but and even at the time, I thought I looked awful anyway. But it's just how it can get distorted looking back. Well, geez, did I look right then? Look at where you are now. Is this recovery really worth it? And I suppose that's normal for anyone going through the process as well, that it will. It's like the ED is like an abusive partner that's constantly, what did you eat today? What did you do? Look at the state. Yeah, it's literally like, yeah, if you were living with an abusive partner that was monitoring what you ate, what you said, what you thought every minute of the day, like, that's what it's like living with it. And I suppose getting away from that then, it's so freeing and strange and like, just lovely not to become your own best friend and not to be that bully in your head monitoring everything you do 24/7.
And it's important as well to highlight that recovery is possible, because a lot of people, and it's a topic that I've touched on a few times on the podcast, and even just last week speaking to Holly Carpenter, for her, and everybody has their own truth and what works for them. And for her, she feels that recovery maybe is unattainable. What keeps her, I suppose, in the safe zone is an acceptance that she could be, you know, re-triggered at any stage. But you're showing that it is possible. It is absolutely possible to make a full recovery.
Yeah.
Not live with it, not live in fear of it, and move away from it.
Well, I suppose when I went to the clinic that I went to get support, I saw people who were fully recovered from the first day. So that was, I never knew, like, I had never gone to the public service or people been telling you can't access help or you're not underweight enough, you're not sick enough. So thankfully, I didn't go through any of that like some people do. And if you're in a bigger body or you're carrying a bit extra, but you might be still experiencing an eating disorder, but because you're not in the underweight category, you're not worthy of, I suppose, the services and the help. Thankfully, I didn't go through any of that. I suppose I went privately when I realised that I had an issue, like, I'd say I was maybe 26, 27.
So the clinic you went to was the Merino Therapy Centre.
Yeah.
And you found it a very positive experience.
Oh, amazing. Like, and I was going for counselling for a couple of years before that, maybe a year before that, because I just felt everything got on top of me. And just, I suppose your stress levels are very high when you have ED, but you're so unaware. You're not aware of the story that you're telling yourself. It's just your norm. It's very busy in your head and you're overanalyzing and overthinking everything. But yeah, so I think going through kind of just general kind of counseling, it kind of became very obvious, okay, like that it's food. And the lady that I was seeing at the time, that she wasn't comfortable, that wasn't her area. So she kind of gave me a few places and Merino was one that I picked, and I'm just so happy that I went there because yeah, from day one I could see people that had recovered and I instantly felt that connection as soon as I went in there. Like, there's group sessions and there's individual one-to-one services, but I thought like, oh god, I'm going to be going into this madhouse now, a group session with loads of people that have eating disorders. Like, I was like, what the hell am I doing? But I suppose I was kind of desperate at that stage that I knew I wanted to get help with, that I just didn't want to live like that anymore. But I remember the first day I was so amazed by how, and I suppose at the time all I took in was appearance, how physically like beautiful everyone was in the room, but how their self-esteem was so low. I also like felt that instant connection because the things that I would say to myself, I'd never really said out loud to anyone else. I was very ashamed and embarrassed and thought it was very weird. But like when I heard other people say it, I was like, oh, like I felt like I just kind of found my tribe, I suppose. And I never really felt like I'd fitted in anywhere like that before. I had good friends and everything, don't get me wrong. And I led a normal life. Like, it wasn't like I was depressed or anything like that. Like, I did leave a very normal life and career and stuff like that. You wouldn't have known from the outside there was anything wrong. It was all very internally. So yeah, I think that was important for me from day one, to see that recovery is fully possible. And I never doubted it, I suppose. But yeah, I think I kind of find it sad that people can't, or they've been told maybe that recovery is impossible, or like even the term like relapse and stuff that goes around like that. It's not even in my vocabulary. Like, once you start to recover and get, I suppose, I'm going to say proper help, like about recovery, not just gaining weight, not just eating and having a normal like movement or exercise routine. It's so much more beyond
dealing
that.
With what is behind it all.
Exactly. Like, that's just the symptom. And like, if you're just putting a plaster on that, you're not really dealing with what's underneath. So that's when the real kind of recovery work happens. And
is there a lot of naivety around that? As in, say, if somebody is looking like they are underweight, do a lot of people think, oh, well, just feed them up and sure, they'll be grand?
Yeah. And the other way, if you're carrying extra,
they'll lose it and be fine.
It's just like, eat less, gain more. And like, that's just so unhelpful for someone who's experiencing such level of distress, like, as in, just to eat more or just not eat more. Like, it's so much deeper than that. Like, and that's, I suppose, what you learn through the recovery process. And I enjoyed listening to yourself and Holly's conversation. I thought it was really interesting and I could relate to so much of it. But yeah, I suppose for me, full recovery is possible. I'd never doubted it. I suppose I could see it. I could feel it all around me. And I suppose I'm proof of it now that you can fully recover. And like, you can move away from like not thinking about food in your body 24/7 and you just start to learn how to live life. Your life, I suppose, when you're in ED, you're restricting your food intake and you're restricting your life. Everything is getting smaller. That's what you want. But like when you start recovering, you just start to, things get bigger. You enjoy life. Like, there's more going on than just the size of your bum. And like, I think as well, not to dish it because it can be seen like, oh, it's just a vanity thing or just a young girl thing. That's not the case. Like, it's just, I suppose that's what you're using as, the behaviours that you're using is more like
control.
For me, I think it was more numbing, I think. Like, okay. I don't think I understood or knew what any sort of emotion was, only good or bad or happy or sad. And like, I used to pride myself on never getting upset or never crying. Like, I just thought I was so tough and nothing could get past me. Do you know that kind of way? And I was very focused on my career and getting things done and busy and creating this illusion of a kind of a, what I thought was a perfect life. So yeah, I think for me anyway, it was definitely a form of maybe kind of numbing, and probably something to control too, I suppose, because if you don't know yourself and you're constantly comparing yourself to others, which I did, like I would have just followed other people's lives, like from people I know that I put on pedestals without ever questioning, like, okay, what does Aoife want? What do we want to do? Or even without taking into consideration my body. And I can remember my first, sorry, I'm probably jumping on
no,
here.
No, you're brilliant, yeah.
But I can remember my first session with one of the therapists in the clinic at Marino, and she'd refer to it as, like, this is going to be like a couples counselling session with your body. And I was like, what the
right,
hell is
interesting,
she on
yeah.
about? Like, tell me about your relationship with your body. And I was like, what? Like, what kind of, like, nonsense is this? Like, it was just a language that was so unknown to me. Do you know that kind of way? It was just like, my body, like, we have a very destructive relationship, I suppose. But it just got me kind of curious, like, what kind of relationship would I like to have with my body? And if I was free, what kind of a relationship could I have with my body, with food? And just kind of getting curious about those questions rather than getting so critical, I suppose. So, like, yeah. just like that, that can be possible. And I remember, like, I used to look at people that would just have a bit of cake and maybe not finish it, or feel like they didn't have to wolf everything down. And I was, like, amazed by these people that could just do that, whereas if I had anything in the house.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
It would be instantly gone because it was either allowed or not allowed. So it just be hoovered up, and then I wouldn't be allowed it again for months. So
yeah,
you just learn balance, and it's amazing. Now I still laugh at sometimes when, like, whatever could be in the cupboard, stuff that I might like. It's just when you're allowing yourself to have it, it's just that pull is gone. I'm just like, I take it or leave it. It doesn't consume my mind anymore.
Yeah. And it is balance, isn't it?
It's balance. Like, you're learning how to live life, I suppose, in a balanced, constructive way. Like, you kind of move from a master of self-destruction to a master of self-care, if you want to say. I know self-care is kind of thrown around a bit.
No, I love it. So when you looked in the mirror back in the day versus when you look in the mirror at yourself now, like, I'm guessing it's like polar opposites, is it?
Polar opposites, yes. But it doesn't mean that I'm going around either and I'm looking in the mirror going, geez, I'm absolutely fabulous. Like, there's still hang-ups I have about my body. And I think when you're free, I suppose when I was going through the recovery journey,
you're more accepting of it now, obviously.
You're accepting, and you can see behind it, and it's not just, it doesn't consume you. It's just like, okay,
you're more than just this.
Like, it's just, that's there, but, like, look what my body does. And it just wouldn't consume me. It's just what it is. Like, there's so much more to me, do you know, that kind of way.
Isn't it weird, though, how you know, say, and the classic is somebody goes through a breakup, particularly I'm speaking from friends of mine, female friends of mine who've gone through breakups. And because, and I've been that soldier myself, you're so upset that you either comfort eat or you can't eat. Mm. But perhaps say if you can't really eat and you drop weight, you're getting all these compliments. Mm. But you could be miserable yeah. and in such inner turmoil.
Yeah.
But physically, what people are seeing
yeah.
is that you look well, but like, but you like might be the opposite of that inside.
Yeah. And weight loss is celebrated no matter what. People don't think of what might be going on behind that. It's just celebrated no matter what.
And you can be so, like, I've seen so many accounts, and it's great to see more and more accounts of people who, and we have the likes of Ross Purcell, who's a fabulous advocate, I feel, for, you know, life after an eating distress and actually embracing living, which is what you're all about as well. And there are so many, which is brilliant. But that, you know, you can, there was one woman, and I can't remember her name, but she's a fabulous account on Instagram where she has photos of herself, she's slimmer. And like to the naked eye, she might look really well because she's slim. Mm-hmm. But she basically says now in her larger body that she's far healthier, physically yeah. healthier inside. But not just that, but healthier in her mind and yeah. in her heart about herself on in every way versus that picture of herself that may have looked a certain way,
yeah.
but it was the absolute opposite. Yeah. And that's an important point to make as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
What we see is not the full picture.
Yeah.
It's not a reflection of our inner health.
Yeah. And I think that's the kind of parallel. It's like weight equates to health in kind of society now, which there's so much more, like, as you just said, like your mental health, your emotional health, your life, everything. Like it's so much more, I suppose. But when you're kind of going through it, that's all you can see. It's just
yeah.
weight is health, and it doesn't matter at what cost, like, I suppose. And I think that's what I'd love to get out of this, that if people are maybe listening, that they might see this in their sons or daughters or friends or family, or they might resonate with it themselves. And just to kind of reach out and seek support, because a lot of the barriers can be even like, I'm not sick enough and like I look fine. But like if something is consuming you and taking over the quality of your life, you deserve to seek help, like, and
yeah.
you can just live a freer, nicer life, like, and yeah.
And be nicer to be around probably as well.
Definitely.
Because you're not obsessed about it.
Exactly.
And people feel that, don't they?
Yeah.
And I say that again as somebody who's gone through different diets, and I know when I've been in the zone myself,
yeah.
that I haven't really been that much crack to be around. I mean, I used to call it like at different phases when I would go through, I'd be doing the no crack diet because I'd be no crack to yeah. be around, you know, because, you know, if carbs make you feel good, and we need a balance in our lives, and they're good for your mood and they're good for your emotional well-being as well. And if you're depriving your body of certain things, you're usually ratty, you're usually in bad form.
Yeah.
You're not much crack to be around. Yeah. So,
and it just comes back, like your body knows what nutrients it needs. Like I'd yeah. always say, your body is your best nutritionist. It knows what it wants if you actually practice listening to it. You don't need a nutritionist. You don't need a plan. Your body is smart and it knows what it needs. You're born in tune with your body. You eat when you're hungry. You stop when you're full. And just along the way that gets lost. So it's just retraining yourself again, and just to tune into your body.
Yes. And is that what you do now? Is it intuitive eating?
I only kind of found out what intuitive eating was, I'd say, this year. And I love following the girls, actually, Intuitive Eating Ireland. I find them brilliant.
Yeah. But in terms of what you've just described, that's what it is. It's tuning
kind of,
into your own body
yeah.
and just eating accordingly.
Yeah. I think I didn't know that was the term and there's principles, but I suppose through recovery, that's what I learned.
That's what you were doing, yeah.
But at the early days, I suppose it's important to know as well that you don't know how to eat intuitively when you have an eating disorder because you're so body
regimented.
And mind disconnected. Like,
yeah, okay.
So it's to kind of, in the initial stages, if anyone's going through it would be important to get a blood test and eat mechanically every 3 hours to get your metabolism back and to get everything going in the body and get, like you mentioned BMI earlier, like your blood test is going to outline a whole lot more than a BMI, like, and get your hormones checked, especially for women, like your hormone levels, like, and you, Holly mentioned last week about her period stopping.
Yeah.
And like when I started going through the recovery process and went for the, like through the clinic, you go and get your bloods checked and you start off from there. And like my estrogen was on the lower level. It was like I'd never missed a period or anything like that, but it was on the lower level. And that was just good information for me. Like, do you know, I'd been on the pill probably, geez, I don't know how long, could have been 15 years, I'd say,
yeah,
10
yeah.
years easily. So yeah, it was just, it's like, and even now if I go to a GP, and I'm not dishing GPs or anything, but like you do need to ask if you want to get your hormone level checked. And it's kind of like, why? That's not standard. But like, it's just to feel comfortable to ask for it, because that can be, there can be so much going on, and that gives you a much better picture than what BMI is going to give you.
So yeah, so I mean, it wasn't just manifesting emotionally or mentally for you, where you were obsessed and you didn't go a day without thinking, what am I going to eat or what am I going to do today exercise wise. So then it had the knock on effect in your friends and family. But then, of course, you were feeling it internally as well. While it may not have been obvious on the scales or on a BMI, as you said, it was showcasing in bloods as well. Was that the wake up call for you?
No, the bloods, I suppose, for me would have been when I started the recovery process.
Okay.
It was advised to get it. I think I was just like, I can't deal with this constant in my head. And like, just like, I just feel like my baseline stress levels were so high. And then if anything happened, like, I don't know whether it was a breakup or like, I remember I'd moved to Dublin to start my new job, the job I'm in now, but it was new at the time.
Mm.
And I just found that transition very difficult. And even though I traveled and lived abroad and always lived in different places, it just, that move really kind of took its hold on me. And I had started with my going out with my partner that I'm with now at the time, and I'd moved from Mayo up to, because I suppose my career was, nothing got in the way of my career, even though we had like a kind of an instant, I suppose a bond, I suppose early days, but it was like, didn't matter, like I have to move to Dublin for this job, like it's in,
yeah.
There's nothing got in the way of my career. Like I used to, like, it's so warped I think now, like I used to think like having kids or a family, like that was a weakness that gets in the way of your game plan, like as in, it's just so funny, like it's literally like I became, I'm not going to say a different person, I just probably discovered who I really was without all the bullshit of the ED in between.
Yeah.
But it's just how it filters into every part of your life, your relationships, like, and when you start the recovery process and when you're not thinking about food 24/7 and you're not ruminating all day long, you've so much more space. It's like, whoa, what will I do with my time? You've so much more options and choices. And whereas before I didn't ever have a choice. I suppose I just thought this is what I have to do. Like I didn't even know the word choice.
You sound like such a, as in now versus the way you were then, you sound like a really different person.
Oh,
because the second I met you outside, I was met with instant warmth from you and loveliness and a feeling of, oh, great, because you instantly just exuded this warmth. But you're describing a person that almost was quite detached or a bit cold.
Yeah, and it's funny because like my close network are still the same from back then. And I always obviously did have some level of warmth because people don't really, only my close network would realise how much I've changed, I suppose.
Right. But within yourself, I suppose, maybe not with other people. I'm getting the feeling that you were just, as you said, you know, that voice in your head was so negative.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And so hard on you.
Yeah.
You were so tough on yourself.
Yeah. Hardship was a big thing. But then as well, I suppose I was maybe trying to mask it so much that I nearly came off the other extreme, that I was Miss Positive Polly. It was such a stark contrast to what was going on internally to what I was, I suppose, portraying to the outside world.
Right.
And it's funny then going through recovery, I probably seem like a bit more of a mess now because I actually feel my emotions and I express them, and I could be a wreck someday. I could be really happy. Like I feel different. I feel vulnerable. I feel exposed.
Whereas, that's good. It's healthy.
Exactly. But I didn't know what any of those things were in the past. It was just like, I don't know, like I just thought
you
I was
would
indestructible.
Shut off your emotions.
Yeah. Yeah. Like from going through the recovery, I suppose, from going through restriction and all that kind of weighing and all that kind of stuff. But then when I started recovering, I thought the freer I was getting, geez, I'm just eating whatever, like I eat whatever I want, but it wasn't freedom. It was more like the feck it button, like going from being so strict to feck it, I'll just have whatever I want, whenever I want. And that, I suppose it's normal to go through that process, that if you go from so restricting that your body, it's nearly like survival, it goes 360 the other way. And you, like for me anyway, and a lot of people I know, it would have been a lot of emotional overeating then as I was going through the recovery process. There was a lot of shame for me with that as well. But I thought like, okay, this is better because I'm not dieting or restricting or going back to my old ways. But it's kind of the same, or what's it, two sides of the same coin.
Yeah.
And then I suppose you get to that kind of sweet spot in the middle where you're not restricting, you're not eating all around you, you're just eating with your body. But it is a process to get there. Like it doesn't happen overnight, and it does involve work. But I always enjoyed the recovery process. I really fully immersed myself in it, and I loved it. I loved getting to know myself because I suppose I was rejecting myself for so long. So it was so interesting. It was like just getting to know somebody and just becoming yourself. And like, then it just infiltrates like that into every part of your life. My job got so much easier. My relationships improved. Like, it's amazing how effective you and productive I became in my job, because food wasn't dictating what I was doing 24/7, and I didn't constantly doubt myself that I wasn't good enough or wasn't able to do it, or comparing what the girl next door was doing, that I just started to believe in myself. And like, it's amazing what you can get done when your mind isn't full of crap. Like,
You just said two words there that I think are really telling, because we're talking about how different are you now, or how have you changed, or how you've become a, you know, a different version of yourself. But you said the words becoming myself. So it's not about becoming a different person.
No.
Is it about just going back to the Aoife that was always there, but she got hijacked along the way?
100%, yeah. And I think, like, my definition of recovery is just discovering who you are.
Yeah.
And I think it was said to me the early days of recovery, you're not your thoughts, you're not your behaviours, what you do. You're separating Aoife from the ED. And that was so helpful, like, because my identity was so wrapped around it. My job, my career, everything was so wrapped up in the ED that it was so helpful to park that and be like, okay, let's get to know Aoife. And like, I definitely found, like, for anyone that maybe is going through it, like, journaling at the start was, and even now I'd still journal every day, but like, just three things I used to kind of write every day, and it just helped shift my mindset and my attitude and everything. It was, what did I do well today, what did I learn, and what would I do differently? And those yeah. three things, like, and it might just seem so simple. And I remember at the start of recovery, it's like, why isn't no one talking about the food and all the weird stuff we do around food? Why is this not, like, I've been so confused, like, I'm coming here for food. But the food is kind of nearly just parked, and it's like, let's just come away from that and let's look beneath the surface. And then eventually the food behaviours and stuff, they just melt away. They're just not, you don't really value them anymore, because you start to, like, I used to hate the question, like, who are you, or what would you like to be, and what would you like to be in 5 years? Because I used to, like, nearly get a panic attack because I was so lost myself. I had no clue. Yeah, so okay. I hated those kind of questions, or if I was on, like, team building exercises with work or anything like that, because I was so...
They made you feel anxious.
Yeah, so lost, like, and yeah, I hated it. But that's what I started to learn, I suppose, going through the recovery. Like, what do I enjoy doing? Who do I admire? Like, what traits do I admire? Like, that kind of stuff. And just, like, getting to know myself, I suppose, and the relationship with myself and my body.
Those top three questions that you mentioned there first,
yeah.
can you say them again? And I'll include them in the show notes as well. If somebody listening wants to maybe jot them down, and if they haven't started journaling, or if they do journal and they want to add it into the mix, that might help.
What did I do well today? What did I learn today? And what would I do differently? And the lingo is massively important, because before I would never see what I did well. It was just that one thing. It mightn't be, it could be what I ate, what I didn't eat. It could be what I did or didn't do, nothing to do with food at all. But it would just be the negative thing that would stand out, and I would ignore and filter out everything else that went well that day. So you're kind of shifting the focus, coming away from that real negative mindset and focusing on what you did well. And then I think the question, what would you do differently, is very important. Instead of like, that was good or bad, it's like, okay, what would I maybe do differently? What did I learn from this? And it just really helps change your mindset, those kind of questions. For me, anyway, I found them brilliant.
Yeah. So that's really, I suppose, practical advice for somebody who is listening and is, you know, connecting with you and feels that, OK, I possibly need to look at this, and maybe what I'm experiencing isn't good for me, and maybe I do need to actually delve into it. But if you're somebody listening who's concerned about a friend or a family member, what would you say is their best way of approaching it? Because sometimes it can be very difficult to approach the topic and knowing what to say. I mean, do you feel like, is there an appropriate way of going about it? Or does, I suppose it depends on the person, does it?
Yeah, no, it's a really interesting question. And like, the group sessions that I would have gone to, like, there was, they would happen twice weekly. And on the second group, there'd be family members or carers that would come in. And I found that so amazing and inspiring to see people's parents or siblings or partners coming into the sessions and wanting to learn about recovery and wanting to learn how to help. Because it doesn't just affect you, it affects everyone around you, whether you want to believe that or not. Like, I would freak out if someone else cooked my meals, or if someone surprised me with something, like, I would resent them even though they were just doing something nice. So like, and like, yeah, you're not, as you said, you're not going to be much crack to be around. You're not going to be, when you're so consumed in yourself, it's like this negative narcissist, like, you're just so self-consumed, I suppose, without even knowing it. And, but yeah, so I think first of all, it's maybe not to be afraid of it. If like, you can identify with what I'm saying, it's not to be afraid of it. that like recovery is possible, and that it's just information that what's going on, these behaviours, it's just information flagging that there's something maybe not right beneath the surface. But it's recovery is very practical and simple. I'm not taking away the ED is very complex and it's a really horrible disorder. I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy, but the recovery can be very simplified. It's very practical. Mm. It's teaching you how to live your life, I suppose, in a constructive way. And the parents and families, and like my own partner, if then he came to some of the group sessions, like
brilliant.
Everything you do, like I'm sure you can relate to a lot of the stuff I'm saying without having an ED. So a lot of the people that come in and learn about it, they learn so much about themselves, and that helps them. They kind of go on a parallel journey of your own self-discovery, even though you mightn't be suffering with ED.
Yeah.
But everything, that's why it's so important that the recovery treatment is not just about the food and the weight, that it's what's beneath the surface, and that people that are supporting you, they can learn, they can go on the same journey with you. And it's not to be afraid of it, because it can be like, I wouldn't change anything, because from having ED, I've learned so much about myself. Like, I wouldn't be who I am now if I didn't go through that.
Yes.
So, and like, yeah, people that are going through, they can be very determined and very creative, but it just, you said hijacked earlier, it just gets hijacked by the ED, but like, you can find that person again.
Yeah, okay.
So, yeah, not to be afraid of it.
That's a really important message.
And maybe if you wanted to broach it, like, oh, I listened to this podcast, just even this Sheila's podcast, did anything kind of resonate with you? And not expect answers either, just let them digest, give it to them. And there might be a lot of resistance, there will be a lot of resistance, but to expect that as well, it's not going to go rosy, I suppose.
Yeah, none of us are perfect. None of us are flawless. Every single one of us has some form of a problem or something in our lives that is causing us struggle or pain or discomfort. And there's nothing wrong with us. Mm-hmm. It's normal, part of living.
Yeah.
But it does require examination. And sometimes that examination is hard, but it's important to, if you can, and if you're in a place to do it, to do that as well. And if you're not able to do it on your own, and if listening to a conversation like this is too difficult, then reach out. There are places available like the Marino Centre and plenty of other, I would imagine, great counsellors, great therapists in this field that are there and they're willing to help. Yeah. Yes, of course, it costs money, which is an issue. And the whole area of eating distress and the facilities and availability of help in this country is a difficult topic, and it is quite controversial. As you said, you have to be in a very particular, I suppose, level of underweight to qualify, which is warped in itself. But we do spend money nonetheless on things that maybe we think matter and don't. Like, say, if somebody is listening to this now and is spending lots of money on diet pills or whatever it is, stop.
Yeah.
And put that money into sitting down with somebody and talking about it.
Yeah.
That'll be time far better spent than, you know, spending money on mad diets that cost that cost a lot.
100%. Like, my recovery investment, time and money, like, it's the best investment I've ever made. And it's had such a knock-on effect on everyone around me. And, like, I think it's information in yourself if, like, it can be a very uncomfortable topic to bring up with your child or your partner or your loved one or whoever it is. But I suppose it's an opportunity, like, if you want to support them as well, like, to get, you learn information about yourself as well, and you can go through it together. And it's, there's going to be ups and downs. Like, I'm not saying recovery is all rosy. There are definitely challenges. It's not linear. It's up and down. It's all over the place. Sometimes you think you're taking loads of steps back, but you're actually going forward. But it doesn't mean I don't go through challenging times because you're free from it. Like, I found becoming a mother very challenging. Like, my little boy is nearly two now, and I found the first 6 months so challenging. Like, I wasn't sleeping. I think it was just those kind of perfectionist traits, kind of a lot of pressure, they were kind of coming in on me a little bit. And I suppose I was vulnerable and hormonal and sleep deprived, and but like, I would never have called that a relapse. It was just a challenging time in my life. But I had my toolbox of recovery tools to get through it.
Yeah.
And like, I think that's the thing, like, just because you've recovered from something, it doesn't mean you're not going, I thought like life was going to be all beautiful and like unicorns, and life is great, but like, everyone still has to deal with ups and downs and challenges and shit in life.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's a given. So it's not to think that everything will be perfect when you recover either. Perfection like doesn't exist, but it's just, you're just living, I suppose.
And when you mentioned there about, you know, when you were going through treatment and when, you know, family members or partners or friends were involved in the process, that sounds vital and so healthy. But there'll also be people whose, you know, I suppose, negative relationship with food may have started in the home, may have been a parent. And that can also be a very difficult thing unless the parent is willing to look at their behaviours, which if they're not, then you have to make a decision where do I just step away
And I've
to protect myself.
100%, like it's creating those boundaries. And I suppose for me, like my family, I suppose I was a grown adult, like I was 26 or 7 living in Dublin away from home for years. My family, like I had told my mother what I was going through and kind of bit, but like she wouldn't have been coming to sessions and stuff. She was living in Clare, like it just, that wasn't what happened. But like my partner came along to a few of them, but I very much kind of went at it on my own path, I suppose. And you do sometimes have to create those boundaries. And I remember saying to people close to me, like my sister, my best friend and my mother, because we would have all talked about diets and I would have been the ringleader, I suppose. But I had to say, OK, like I'm going through this now. I'd appreciate if you just didn't bring this up around me. We don't have those conversations.
Very good.
And that boundary has kind of, it has stayed, I suppose.
And boundaries are so important.
Yeah. And it's not that, I suppose my boundaries are kind of, my boundary was very strict and I was like, everyone that talks about diets and wants to lose weight is bad. That's what I kind of thought.
OK.
But it's not. It's like you can get that compassion now that like, just because you're experiencing discomfort in your body or you might want change, that's okay, you know? And it took me a long time to accept that, that like we all have kind of different kind of issues with our bodies and stuff like that. And that's okay. You're just human. That's a human experience, I suppose. But it, it can become a lot easier. So yeah, but I have met people from the clinic and stuff that did have to put those boundaries with their family. The families weren't willing to engage and there was issues there and maybe very, I don't know, strict upbringing and things like that and going at it alone. And I've seen people recover in that sense as well, with families, without families, going at it on their own. Like obviously it's a nicer time for the person if the people around them are kind of
on board.
Yeah, on board.
But there is a wider societal pressure as
well
that we've been bombarded with from an early age.
Yeah.
That, you know, looking a certain way means that you're worth increases.
Yeah.
That's why I speak about self-worth a lot. I'm very passionate about the topic because I think we have a warped sense of what worth actually is and that it's not based on how we look. But unfortunately, in society, there are comments that are made on how we look all the time. So where would you stand on that? What have you learned through the recovery process? Because often we compliment people on how they look or if they've dropped a few pounds. Yeah. I've done it myself.
Yeah, oh, so have I. And like some people listening to this might be like, what the hell is Eva on about? She was the ringleader of everything the opposite of what I promote now. And I was. And like I'm removing that shame, I suppose. I didn't know any different. And a lot of people might be in the same boat. So just try not to have any judgment or shame there if that is the case. But yeah, I would be.
And we can always change.
Exactly.
Every day is an opportunity to start again.
And to learn. And like, I think like I'd be a big believer, like I'd never comment on anyone's weight. I might say you look well, you look great, but it wouldn't be you look, have you lost weight, have you gained weight? And I find that really, I just find it a really awkward conversation now, even though, as I said, I was the ringleader of it before. But I'm just like, it's so unnecessary. And when I hear it now, and like, it's not that I'm immune to everyone around me doesn't talk about that. I still hear it, but I can just redirect the conversation. And like, just don't comment on people's size. Don't comment on people's body. Don't comment on what they're eating.
Yeah.
And like, as well, I suppose we mentioned like parents and families earlier, I suppose it's not to create blame either. And if your son or daughter is experiencing it, like, because I know my mum was like, how didn't I know that was going on? And she felt so guilty. Do you know what I mean? But like, none of us are immune to it. Like, we are all growing up with that kind of culture of diet culture. And like, your worth is based on your appearance and your size. So like, I think it's very much, yeah, it's just to kind of be willing to open up and learn a kind of different way, I suppose. And relearn, I suppose, get rid of old beliefs and bring in the new beliefs. But yeah, I would be. And even I find it funny, since I've become a mother, I've probably got a bit more kind of passionate about it, because I find like people just would comment on my child size. I'm like, he's not even two. And like, it's not in a, no one's doing it in a malicious way, but it's just so funny from a baby. Geez, he's a fine big baby. And like, you know, a few family members be like, oh, little fatty. And like, I'm probably a bit sensitive to it as well after what I've been through. But I'm like, just don't comment on kids, families. Like, and I know my little boy is very sensitive, like nothing to do with food or anything, but I can see he's a really sensitive little boy. So I'm kind of mindful of those things. Like, just, And I'm so glad that I've recovered, because there will never be a thing like there's good or bad food in my house.
Yeah,
or,
and
like,
you know what? That's why it's great that you did this work before you became a mother. And it's just the way it happened, I suppose. Yeah. But you're now in a brilliant position where you have learned so much and you've seen the pitfalls. You'll be far more highly attuned to it of what not to do.
Yeah.
Because I think there is a lot of that, even from an early age. It may seem innocent, but kids and are compared to each other, siblings compared to each other, cousins.
You can take that on a deeper level. Like,
I mean, I grew up with it myself.
Yeah.
Where there was commentary. It was innocent and it was done in a playful way.
Yeah.
But then underneath it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why is it so innocent? If it depends on the child and how sensitive they are to it and whether they take it in.
Yeah.
Comments on whether you've a bit of weight on, or you're too skinny, or you're too this. Or we're not too anything. We are what we are.
Yeah. Yeah.
And God, it's huge. We need to normalise the conversation and have a far healthier conversation around it in every way. And you have done a real service here today. But travelling from Mayo to sit down and have this conversation is a very selfless thing to do. And I am certainly learning from you, and you've allowed me to really delve into my own upbringing and my own relationship with food. And luckily, I think I'm in a pretty good place now. But it's because I did work on myself in all of other areas.
Yeah.
And certainly I can resonate with a lot of what you said.
Yeah.
So thank you. So look, for anyone listening, if you're concerned about it, just open your heart, I suppose, and realise that, you know, people are suffering in different ways. And I think we've mentioned it before in this podcast, but particularly in this year of isolation, there's probably a lot more disorder thinking around food and the way we look, and even getting back into normal life now. And there's a lot of people have a lot of issues and a lot of stresses around it. So it's a topical conversation to have.
And so, I think as well, we could talk all day about the issues in society, but like, we're learning, we can pass this message on to other people. And like, I love the quote, even just to finish, like, be the change you want to see. Because I can get so frustrated about the diet accounts and the diet industry. But like, by me being free and passing it on to my son, that's another free person. You're learning, your kids will learn. So I think it's just, we could rant all day about the services and the way things are, but like, the more people that open up to this conversation are willing to learn, it's going to have an impact, like.
Yes. So Aoife, thank you so much. Any last words?
No, I think just to finish with that, be the change you want to see, and that recovery is possible, I suppose, and definitely worth it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
I've absolutely loved this. Thank you.
Please check the show notes for any more info that might be helpful to you. And if you like this podcast, why don't you show your support by leaving a rating or a little comment on Apple, or by clicking follow on Spotify. I'd be so grateful. You've been listening to Ready to Be Real Conversations.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.